ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley from ABC News Daily, the podcast that brings you one big story affecting your world each weekday in just 15 minutes.
The axiom in the investor community is never bet against Elon, because even if one has questions about his mental health, the simple message of the numbers at his companies are highly confidence creating.
Join me for ABC News Daily. Find us on ABC Listen.
So we have fresh data out on the property market, and it confirms what we have been talking about in recent months. Property prices are falling nationally. In fact, month on month, it was the biggest decline since December 2022. So what's going on? Where's the pain being felt? And where does property go from here? And I also want to deep dive into rents, which are rising at an extraordinary clip. Is that part of the affordability picture? Welcome to ABC Business Daily. I'm Carrington Clark.
And I'm ABC business reporter Steph Chalmers.
Steph, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
We're dealing with one of our national obsessions, which is property prices. So the cycle is at the end of the calendar month, we basically get these releases both from Cotality, which is the one we're really going to be focused in, but also from PropTrack, which I'll deal with a little bit today as well. They try to track exactly what's happening in the property market. And obviously it's different than trying to work out the value of companies in the stock market, where you can take a share and times it by the number of shares and work out what the value is, and we get a clear guide each day. Obviously not all properties are for sale, and not any two properties are exactly the same. And so to try and work out what's happening nationally is difficult, and different companies have different formulas to try to make those, to make a guess at exactly what's happening. But this data does confirm what we have been hearing anecdotally, and the little bits of data that we've seen peppered through the last few months, which is that there has been a stark step change in the property market, which was running so hot at the end of last year. We've now seen a few months of losses when it comes to Sydney in particular. It's pretty pronounced now, over the quarter losing more than 3%. Melbourne down 2.6%. Nationally, it was the biggest month-on-month fall since December 2022, down 0.4%. What did you make of these numbers?
Yeah, it really confirmed the trend we've been seeing in recent months. And in fact, there were some revisions by Cotality to the previous monthly data. So they think that dwelling values now peaked in March. So it's almost as though this trend has been playing out a little bit more pronounced and for longer than we initially thought. And if you see it peaking in March and then kind of declining from there, that really points to that interest rate factor, as we had the rate hikes in Feb and then again in March, and we didn't get the budget tax changes, which are now also a factor. Those didn't get announced to May. So we can see that even ahead of those property tax changes being discussed, there was a real turn in sentiment in the property market. As you say, it's really being led by Sydney and Melbourne. Sydney values were down 1.2% in the month. Melbourne was down 1%. And we also saw Canberra down 0.6%. And I was writing last week about some forecasts for the year ahead from Domain, and those were the three cities that they saw declining. So it seems like it's playing out as people had been forecasting in terms of where the actual pullback in property prices is. And then in some of the other cities, they're holding up better, but the growth rates are slowing. So that's why we've seen what Cotality said was a market fully in decline now, but obviously there are still some cities where prices are growing, but at a much slower pace, and due to sort of specific factors in particular cities around supply and things like that.
The context is really important in that we still, even with these most recent falls, property prices are up, according to Cotality, 7.3% over the year. I mean, that is a very fast clip, and is making housing even more unaffordable. So even with this pullback, prices are still up. Now, yes, there are going to be examples of people who bought in at the peak or bought badly and are now underwater. They're in negative equity. But for most people who've been holding on for a while, they're probably okay. And of course, there's just that kind of fundamental question, isn't there, about housing prices are not like stock values. Housing primarily is shelter,
yeah,
and it's a human need. So when we talk about, on one hand, people get excited about the value of their home going up, but we also know that housing was increasingly unaffordable for a lot of people. They couldn't get into the property market. That meant that they had to, you know, had to deal with the rental market and all the insecurity that comes from that. And I want to deep dive into rents in a moment. But we do kind of treat this in some ways as a scorecard for the economy because this is such an important factor in how wealthy people feel. But there are winners from lower home prices, aren't they? Those people who want to be able to buy in and get the security of owning their own place.
Exactly. And I think it's really interesting. Obviously, these are sort of water cooler chats that people are having or at the barbecue on the weekend. But I don't know, it kind of seems like when house prices are rising, you have a lot of people sympathetic to the plight of people wanting to break into the market and how difficult it is and something needs to change. And then when things start to go in the other direction, it's kind of all like,
people
what
freak
do we
out
do?
Quickly.
Yeah, what yeah. do we do? And, you know, disclosure, I own an apartment. And to me, I'm not tracking what it's worth on any one day or another because the prospect of upgrading is so, so out of the realm of possibility in a market like Sydney. So if you are, I guess, viewing your home that you own as shelter, you're probably not, you know, tracking the price on a day-to-day basis. But as you say, in Australia, housing has increasingly become sort of a facility to build wealth or an investment. So that's kind of the lens we get into in this conversation, is about, you know, the return on your investment. Oh, if I had to sell tomorrow, would I make a profit or a loss? But most people, or the people that are kind of in this affordability conversation who are looking for shelter to put over their head, you know, they're not going to be looking at it in that way. It's more about, can I afford to pay rent or can I afford to buy somewhere where I can live?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think for most people, the movements in the property market won't make a big impact to how wealthy they are, because even if someone were to sell in the market, if they were going to buy a similar type of product, they needed to move for work, for example, they wanted to move for a lifestyle reason, and they were buying into a similar market, well, then if it drops by 10%, both properties drop by 10%, you're net-net, you're okay. The people who do become more interested in what's happening is potentially people who are looking to downsize or getting close to retirement. That could be someone who's concerned that, you know, if they're going to be selling a more expensive property to buy something cheaper and they were hoping to book a bigger difference between those two prices, they might start to get anxious. And of course, it impacts people who have investment properties because they get very concerned about what that investment is worth. But property has become this major vehicle for Australians to try to both park their money and to build wealth. It's something like, you know, 2/3 of Australians own their own home. About 2/3 of our household wealth is tied up in housing. So it's a big component and much bigger than a lot of comparable countries. I think the concern right now, there's always kind of fever pitch talk about property in Australia. It is a national obsession, but I think it is particularly pronounced this year because we've seen these interest rate rises, but because of these taxation changes coming through at the same time. And that is, people are just getting anxious, I think, about, well, how low can it go? And we are seeing predictions from economists that perhaps we're going to see it go down a few more percent this year. Some are suggesting it could drop by another 7 to 10%. Now, again, if it's up 7.3% and it drops 7%, you're still basically in the position you were a year ago. That's not a big hit for most people, again, who aren't buying and selling in that market. But it might be for those people who have bought at the peak and if for that, for whatever reason, have to sell when the market has gone a lot lower. That can be a major financial cost.
Yeah, and I think what we've seen is there were some recent stats from Cotality as well about record resale profits. It is really the people who made a loss were far more likely to have bought in the last couple of years. And then they are also the people who would potentially be more likely to fall into trouble with their home loan because they would have bigger loans, perhaps bought on a government scheme with only a 5% deposit or something like a guarantor, some arrangement where they don't really have any equity. So any fall then, if they have to realise the loss, is then going to be particularly painful. So it does affect people, but I think sometimes the conversation can make it seem like the value of your home affects you on a day-to-day basis, when for most people it probably doesn't. But as you say, investors, we were talking to Westpac as part of our coverage of the story, and they are already seeing quite a significant pullback of investors in their loan book. So one of their economists told us that applications for investment loans have fallen by around 20%, and they're expecting further weakening there. And they're not seeing yet any kind of swivel of interest towards new builds. So it seems like the government, with its changes to negative gearing and allowing that to continue for new builds for people who aren't grandfathered under the existing scheme, that isn't really translating yet into people seeking out investments in new builds, at least. So an interesting shift. I guess it'll remain to be seen whether that will pick up. But I guess with overall sentiment in the market, high interest rates making it harder for people to get approved for loans, we're seeing,
and there's just a technical impact that you can get. You will get a smaller loan at the moment based on the current interest rates than you would otherwise get.
Exactly. So even for the prospective home buyers who might be looking at the market and saying, oh, finally, prices are at least not growing as fast, if they're in one of the smaller cities, or if you're in Sydney and Melbourne, perhaps prices in the suburb you're looking might already be falling. Compared to a year ago, yes, it's still more expensive than a year ago, and they also would have been able to potentially borrow more a year ago if they're still earning the same salary and interest rates were lower.
Yeah, I think what's definitely changed is there was so much heat in the market last year that people were concerned if they didn't buy now, then their prices were going to jump another 5, 10%. So they felt a desperate need to try to grab a property right now. The opposite is now true. And we do see these cycles. That is important. We have seen, even though property has been a pretty good bet for most people in Australia, some people have lost money, and we have had multiple cycles over the last, you know, multiple decades where we will see pretty significant falls and then a rebound. But there is high population growth. There's lots of reasons why Australia still has been a good place to invest in the longer term. But yes, people can get caught up. But of course, you see headlines about, is this the perfect storm of things coming together? And what does seem to have drastically changed is that speculative element has dropped out of the market at the moment. I do want to compare just quickly to some of the statistics from PropTrack, who also does their own analysis of what's happening in the property market. It mostly accords with what we see from Cotality. It says prices fell by 0.3%, so pretty similar to the 0.4%. It says prices are up about 5.8% over the past year, so a little bit lower than what we see with Cotality. But again, says the peak was back in March, and we have seen these 3 months of declines. I want to focus in on rent, because I think this is often missed in the conversation when we talk about affordability. And I think because house prices, property prices have been on such a tear in recent years, that has been the big focus. And we talk in terms of how many years does it take for someone to save up for a 20% deposit, or how much of someone's income do they need in order to service a mortgage? And because it has been a dream for so many people to own a home, that has been a real focus. But what we have seen in rents in the past 5 years in Australia has been really extraordinary. The growth has been so harsh for renters, and the vacancy rates have been so painful that it's gotten increasingly difficult for people to be able to afford to rent a place in Australia. So Cotality says over the past year, rents went up 5.9%. I mean, that's well above inflation. It's come down a little bit from the peaks that we saw in the immediate aftermath of COVID, when we did see a massive increase in a short period in net migration. Rents have risen 41.7% over the past 5 years. That means an average $217 a week extra in rent. The vacancy rate currently is 1.6%. To compare, in the 5 years before COVID, it was 3.3%, so it's halved. So the availability is effectively halved over that period. And to give you an idea, rents before COVID were rising on average less than 1%. So to see 5.9% is just an extraordinary rate for people to be dealing with. Do you think it gets the focus that it deserves when we talk about affordability in the Australian property market?
It's interesting because we hear a lot about would-be home buyers or, you know, aspiring first-time home buyers. And really, in most cases, those are people who are renting. They are renters. So as you say, we have rent prices increasing. That's alongside broader inflation pressures that we've been seeing. So that means that those home buyers' costs are rising. The market is further getting away from them over the course of a year. Yes, this month it has gone backwards in some cities, but you can just see how it is really a perfect storm for renters as well, trying to deal with, you know, having to offer higher prices than advertised rent prices just because of the lack of availability, as you say, the really, really low vacancy rates. So the price is also, you know, perhaps having to chuck in an extra $100 just to even secure viewing of some properties in these really hectic cities where you see lines across the block for really basic properties. So I think it is interesting because really who wouldn't be renting as an aspiring buyer unless you have an arrangement with family where yeah. you can stay at home and those kind of things. So that kind of further makes the property home ownership dream something that's unequal in terms of access, particularly in cities like Sydney and Melbourne and Brisbane, where prices have risen so much.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, for some people, it is a choice that they want to rent because they like the flexibility that allows. They don't want to be tied down to a large mortgage, particularly given how expensive home prices became in Australia. But for a lot of people, they do see it as a kind of stepping stone to eventually buying. And as you say, if more and more of your income is being eaten up by increasing rents, then that makes it more difficult to save for that deposit, and just makes it more difficult generally to live. And we did see from that most recent inflation data how much high rent increases are actually driving the inflationary picture in Australia as well. It was the biggest driver of that last inflation number that we saw. There was electricity, high electricity increases as well, but rents was a pretty sizable component of that. And it is, I think, one of the issues that the government hasn't figured out a way to tackle. So I'll be interested to see how much this catches on, particularly if you're seeing property prices coming down, then that helps the affordability question when it comes to purchasing, which again was one of the reasons why we saw these taxation changes. They wanted to make it more affordable. The government is being very careful to not say they want prices to be lower, because you can understand how that might be politically difficult for them. But for things to be more affordable, you need prices to drop because we're not going to get wages increasing at the rate necessary to make it more affordable.
Yeah, it was interesting in the Cotality report as well. They noted that because of the increase in rents and they're rising faster than home values, that actually is improving the rental yield of properties, and it may actually re-motivate investors to look at existing housing as an investment, even if they can't use negative gearing. They did say, you know, it is really hard to get a positive rental yield because other costs are also rising. So maintenance costs of homes, yeah. loan costs and things like that. So it's not like suddenly every property that was previously negatively geared can suddenly be positively geared because rents are rising. But yeah, I just thought that was interesting that with rents rising, yeah. it could actually have a different effect than perhaps the intended effect on the investor market.
And that is seen by analysts as one of the flaws on how low property prices can get, because there is still such demand for housing. People obviously need somewhere to live when you've got high population growth, or if people want to live in smaller family units, that is driving demand. And we just do not seem capable as a country of supplying enough dwellings for that rising demand. And so that will eventually be a floor under the prices. But again, the question is how much of the huge increase in property prices that we've seen in recent years was speculative based on people being concerned that all they're going to do is go up and up and up, and therefore just being willing to plow as much of their money as they possibly can get, including their money plus the money that they can borrow from the bank, and put it into housing thinking it was a safe bet. And again, what we have seen overseas is that sometimes these very hot markets can burst and they can cause catastrophic problems. Look at Japan, look at Ireland, look at what happened in the United States. And now I'm not obviously suggesting we're on the brink of something similar, but I think it is always important for people to look at these cautionary tales. And speaking of cautionary tales, we have the government announcing potential changes to the way that the big four accounting, consulting, auditing firms operate here in Australia. This is after the latest scandal engulfing KPMG, which doesn't show any signs really of slowing down. The government is asking for people to enter into a conversation about potentially changing the way that these firms operate. And I think some of the suggested changes could be quite a departure from what we have seen up until now, particularly the idea of looking at separating auditing functions and consulting functions because of potentially the risk that that creates within these organisations. What do you make of the way that the government is framing this discussion paper, this process, and do you think it's likely that we could see a major change in the way that these firms operate?
Yeah, so they've sold this as an options paper. They're putting the options out there. So some of those options, as you say, include sort of splitting or structurally separating the various arms of these firms where there are potential conflicts of interest, which we really have seen play out in the recent scandal with KPMG, where we had conflicts of interest between audit clients and other clients and information being used from one client that should have been confidential to try and win business elsewhere. And then in the previous scandal we had with PwC, which was government consulting work on policy then being used to advise companies on how to get around those policy changes. So both those cases, I think, really clearly show how conflicts of interests can be catastrophic in this area. And in terms of separating the various arms, we saw that happen in the wake of the PwC scandal, where they sold off that government consulting business for practically nothing because they weren't going to win many government contracts in the wake of that scandal, so didn't have much value at that point. But it reminded me a lot of in the wake of the Banking Royal Commission, where we saw this sort of reversal of the real vertical integration we'd seen in Australia's big four banks, where they brought in things like financial services, financial advice and superannuation, insurance, all these other arms outside their kind of traditional wheelhouse were brought in-house. And then that has been unwound over the course of the last 5 to 10 years, really, as the risk was kind of seen as too high. And also the public scandals create a reputational risk as well. So they have to weigh up the increased regulatory costs versus the benefit from owning those businesses as well. So even if this doesn't end up happening formally, you have to wonder if there could be some sort of, you know, desire to split off various arms just to avoid the reputational risk as well.
Australia is such a small market, and in so many areas there is a real concentration. We only have a few players. You know, we have the big four accounting firms, you have the big four banks. Occasionally you get a little relative, well, what was once an upstart in, say, a Macquarie who takes it up to them. But there is particularly what I think has become apparent as this scandal has generated so many headlines and stories is there wasn't a lot of choice for these big companies, I should say, about who to choose as your auditor. You know, it comes down to a pretty small field over and over again between really the big four, which one of the big four is going to win. I don't know how you necessarily overcome that, but potentially at least if you're splitting the functions, structurally separating them, maybe that is a solution to some of the perceived problems. There is also this suggestion that perhaps the big four will come under the Corporations Act. The partners model means that they're not currently covered, which means ASIC has very little involvement in regulation. That could be a significant change if that happens. And again, I think a lot of people probably, I'm sure the public at large, weren't aware that that partner model wasn't covered by corporations law in the same way. So I think that is potentially going to be a change. But yes, it does have echoes of what we saw through the Banking Royal Commission in the lead up, I think, where people eventually thought this system isn't working in the best interests of the public, and therefore there needs to be a substantive change to it. I will be fascinated to see what kind of response we see from the industry itself and what businesses think. Obviously, one of the arguments about having these big corporations is always economies of scale, that you're able to offer a better product by having integrated services. I'm sure that will be part of it, but given how much damage has been done to them, to their brands, to their reputations, I think that might be difficult for them.
And they're obviously part of global groups as well. They don't exist in isolation. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see how it's dealt with. As you say, it's not just the concentration amongst the firms themselves. It's also Australia doesn't have that many large companies to be major clients overall. So one of the other options presented was that firms would have to publicly tender for their audit services every decade. So that
because
they
this is finding out that certain organisations had the same auditor in place for decades and decades and decades, I think was quite shocking. I was not aware that people would have these relationships, and it obviously seemed to be potentially problematic.
Exactly. And I think, you know, when you're buying shares on the share market, you get those financial results twice a year. They are audited and you are supposed to have confidence that that has been done completely impartially, that those auditors would be, you know, emboldened to question anything that looks a little bit dodgy and, you know, really take it to those firms. So I think it is a fair enough thing to raise about should there be some sort of mandated turnover at least. But I just thought it was interesting. Obviously, it's a completely different case with Anthony Albanese's data breach with CBA and the young workers at Ernst & Young. But it just the fact that we're such a small market that you can probably bet where the Prime Minister has his home loan, because so many Australians would have a bank account with CBA, if not their primary account, just a secondary account. I think it just really highlighted, as you say, what a small market we are and the risks that creates, I think.
Yeah, and I think that question about culture, which was so central to what was happening in the Banking Royal Commission, about what type of culture do we have at these organisations. And I think what has been worrying about the KPMG scandal, which obviously is still contested in different areas, was you might accept this kind of behaviour in the management consulting kind of arm, but the idea that auditors weren't above reproach I think has been quite shocking for people. I think people think of them as very serious, kind of boring. You want them to be kind of serious, boring, risk-averse, very careful.
Not in the headlines, hopefully.
No, not in the headline, yeah, but also above reproach and not. And I think the difficulty when you hear about some of the behind-the-scenes processing, the bidding for business, that is difficult when you're an auditor, because you don't want the skill set of these auditors to be sales pitches. You know, you want them to be very careful, considered people, and not in any way flashy, I think. And so I don't know exactly how you set up a regulatory environment to make sure that that's the type of behaviour that is rewarded. I mean, punishments, there do exist serious punishments for auditors who get things wrong, but it feels like with this particular scandal, unfortunately, there became a bit of a cowboy attitude even among the audit functions of these particular partnerships.
Yeah, and that was part of the options presented as well, is putting greater sanctions for breaches of auditing. So I think, you know, even just putting these options out there probably will signal to these firms how serious this is. You know, there can be
not going away.
Yeah, there can be an element of just saying, "Hey, this threat of further regulation is hanging over you. Maybe do it yourselves before we have to do anything in law."
Yeah, let's see how this plays out. I think Senator Deb O'Neill, in particular, does not seem to want to let this be done with. So I think there's a lot to go, and I'll be fascinated to see what they come up with after this. This call for input. That is it for today's episode of ABC Business Daily, and we'll be back with another episode for you tomorrow. And in case you missed it, you can check out today's Tax Week bonus episode in the feed right before this one. We'll be dropping these first thing in the morning across this week. Make sure you're following us on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to send in a question, you can email abcbusinessdaily@abc.net.au. Catch you next time, Steph.
Bye.